Okay, so hey, welcome to another episode of Cover to Cover With. This is Jordan Blum, the founder and editor-in-chief of the Bookends Review. I'm here with Michael Dickel, a creative writer, essayist, photographer, and teacher who served as an editor at several literary journals, currently serves as the chair of the Israel Association of Writers in English, and has published fiction, poetry, and photography in many collections and magazines, including his two latest books, 2015's War Surrounds Us, which is his third book of poetry, and last year's palm reading, After the Toad's Garden. So thanks for joining me, Michael.
Thank you, Jordan. It's fun to be here.
Yeah, it's quite an introduction, too.
Yeah, it is.
But congrats on any... Huh?
Hmm? Is that really me?
Yeah, congrats on all of that, of course.
Thanks. Thank you.
But before we get into any of that, you told me that you have family roots in Philadelphia, which is where I'm located.
I guess where
Bookends is located, of course, you know, because of that. So I wonder exactly who is in Philadelphia. You weren't born here, correct?
I was not, but the rest of my other three older brothers were. And my parents grew up there in the Germantown area,
okay,
and Cheltenham area. And actually both my parents graduated from Cheltenham High School.
Oh.
My father got one of his degrees, I think, is in at Temple University.
Oh, okay.
And my grandfather, when he came from Germany at the turn of the 20th century, as a child, his family settled into Philadelphia. So I go back a couple generations there on my father's side, and a little bit further on my mother's side, I think. And let's see, I guess all of my aunts and uncles, except for one of my aunts, grew up in the same neighborhood and actually knew each other while they were growing up in Philadelphia area. But they all ended up moving elsewhere. My aunt ended up in Florida, my uncle in New Jersey, not far from Philadelphia. My grandfather went to Maryland. So we went to the Midwest. My parents went to the Midwest before I was born.
Oh, wow. Yeah, so you certainly do have roots here.
Yeah.
At least.
My grandmother on my mother's side and my aunt lived in Bucks County right up until through high school and into my adulthood, helped move my aunt to live with another aunt in California.
Okay. Yeah, so I'm pretty much as close to Bucks County as you can get without being there. I'm about a mile away from what used to be called Franklin Mills Mall. Now it's Philadelphia Mills, but I refuse to call it that. Like, right by Neshaminy, the whole area, Torsdale.
Yeah, actually, I think I remember hearing of Franklin Mills Mall. It's been a while since I've been there.
Yeah. So then I wonder what made... No, go ahead. No, I wonder what made you... when and why you moved to Jerusalem, then, and if you miss America.
Yeah, sometimes I miss America. Right now, I'm not sure... Given the last election, I'm not sure whether I'm missing much. But... I do miss America at times, it's true. About 10 years ago, I moved to Jerusalem. I came here on a sabbatical from work and was studying here when the Second Lebanon War broke out the summer I was here. But I met someone here, and now I'm married to her, and we have a family.
Oh, great.
She's American, but she moved here at 3 or 4 with her family.
Wow.
So she's really Israeli. And I'm Jewish, and I've visited Israel several times before that. I was very interested in Israel, interested in the arts here, and interested in some of the spiritual, mystical stuff of the Kabbalah and its relationship to art. And I like the land. I do like the land, but I miss America. There are a lot of things. Israel is not as much like America because I thought when I was visiting to live here.
What are some of the major differences? Especially the ones, I guess, that you weren't expecting.
It's more bureaucratic than I expected. And it's... people are more direct. I mean, we think of New Yorkers in America being direct, but New Yorkers are very polite and laid back compared to the way Israelis can be. And
that's what I've heard.
I grew up in the Midwest, so I'm used to more laid back, I guess.
Yeah.
Some of the difficulties in negotiating the bureaucracy. Mostly it's the bureaucracy, I think.
Okay.
It's very different. It's very centralized. It's a lot of heavy bureaucracy to do many things.
Hmm. That's what I've heard. I've never been there, but I am technically I'm Jewish, but I'm very much I identify as agnostic. I don't really follow any of that. So like, yeah. You know, Passover happens, and but my brother-in-law is Israeli, yeah. So my niece and nephew are half Israeli. And I've been okay. I've always wanted to go. I've heard I should have, you know, when I was in high school, I should have gone on the birthright trips and stuff.
Yeah, but I don't know how old you are. You can do it up to like 25, 26.
I'm 29 now.
Not too late, I think.
But maybe someday, just on my own.
Yeah.
So something else that...
Well, hi, Pesach Sameach to you.
Huh?
Happy Pesach holiday. Chag Pesach Sameach.
Oh, that's you as well.
Chag Pesach Sameach.
You as well. I missed my sister's Seder, unfortunately, because I was teaching on Monday.
Oh,
so I would have gone for that, yeah.
Yeah.
So something else that I noticed is that you renamed your blog... to fragmentarily metaphor play in an attempt, from what I understand, to take the focus away from you a bit and make it more about a place to promote artists that you admire. So I wonder what fueled this and how important...
It's true.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I wonder...
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. What fueled you to do this? And then, in general, I guess, how important do you think it is that artists help each other out? Because I notice, you know, on Facebook, a lot of, you know, I'm quote-unquote friends with a lot of people in the indie lit scene. And, you know, we're always sort of sharing each other's articles and promoting each other. And, you know, just I've noticed that if I'm friends with, you know, I find somebody, we have maybe 15 mutual friends all from sort of the same community.
Right. I think it's important. I think long before social media it was important, and you had, if you go back a ways, you had people like Robert Bly talking in the 60s, how important, and others, but I'll pick on Robert Bly, he's from Minnesota, and I know him a little, and his work a little better, but he, talking about the importance that poets should be reviewing poetry, and should be writing about it, not just writing it, partly to bring audience to it, and to open it up to audience, and partly to share the works of people we like a lot with other poets, but not just with other poets, with readers, so that they get read, and partly as a community thing, and I think it's useful to do that. I do. I actually, when I was in graduate school, I was the editor of the book review section of the University of Minnesota newspaper, The Daily, which at the time was a daily. I think it went down to three times a week a little bit later. But so we had a weekly book review section. And I thought that was I started out by writing for it, and then I became one of its editors, and then I became the editor in charge of it, and then we had sort of a 2-year term, and someone else took over. But it was I think it's important to read work, to think about it, to write about it, to share it, to open it up to readers who might not understand what's going on, to help them see it. I'm less interested in sort of the subjective, I liked it, I didn't like it, it's good, it's bad. It's more like sharing it for other people and letting them know what I see and how I get into it and what I like about it. And maybe that will bring other readers. And I have started shifting that way. My blog was mostly my work. I had occasionally had someone else's work. I did occasionally write about other people and occasionally review, but more and more I've been feeling that I want to expand that. Partly that I was working last year, I was working with the Woventail Press, which is a website and journal, online journal, that works with artists and writers and does shares their work. Basically, people who are online. The editor really thought that there were a lot of people online that were really good that other people didn't know, so she started this project, and I worked with her for quite a while, and I thought it's important to do that. I like what we were doing. For personal reasons, I stopped working on that particular journal, but decided that I really wanted to move my blog that way, not in the least competitively, but more adding more voices like that of sharing people. The other thing is, a couple of years ago, I was at an international conference in Salerno with 100,000 Poets for Change, and I met a lot of poets from all over the world. Literally, every continent was represented at the conference,
oh, wow.
And there were not poets from every single country, but there are poets from a number of countries. There are some poets who weren't allowed to come by other countries. 100,000 poets for change are political activists, and sometimes they get in trouble at home. But I met a lot of people, a lot of good poets, a lot of people I didn't know that well before or at all, and got to hear their work and got to meet them as poets. Some of those are the people that I've been sharing on my blog in the past year or so since that conference, 2 years, I guess now. And also I realize I do have this community, like you're talking about, Facebook, Twitter. There's a big overlap, but it's not entirely overlapping. And there are people whose work I like, and I think other people don't know them, and that's a shame.
Yeah,
and I'd like to share. Like, the last couple of posts I put up, one was Gary Lundy, who I've known for decades, and we met at a conference but became close personal friends, largely because we were hundreds of miles apart. We did that on email, but we've in person many times and for lengths of time. And he has two books out, same press as me, Israel's Press, and not a lot of people know his work. And so I put him up, and I actually wrote a few. I think his work can be difficult for people because it's experimental. So I actually put a few paragraphs describing what I see and what I think is going on with his work so that people might find it easier to get into and not have to work so hard. And hopefully then they get rewarded and work harder to get what more might be in there that I don't see myself. And then Jamie Deeds, who does a tremendous work herself, she has a website, a blog that she does a lot of sharing other people's work, other poets, other work. She has a Sunday, every Sunday she does a thing of announcements and calls. And she's the editor-in-chief of the Bee Zine. I'm a contributing editor there now.
Okay.
She's sort of modest about her own work. And so I thought it would be nice to I like her poetry. It's not, like Gary is very much, one could say, experimental avant-garde. She's not experimental avant-garde, but she's out there in real ways, emotionally, spiritually, as a political activist. So I was interested in putting a couple of her poems in, too. Nice. And I have some other poems. Some poems will be coming from India. I ran some poems from someone from Kosovo. And I hope to make it an international kind of... We're not... poetry isn't happening in little enclaves so much anymore because of the internet, basically.
Yeah, I mean, it's so easy to share and to get your voice out there, at least have a platform to post it, if not to spread it as easily, I guess. So it's great that you're doing it. And especially with the analysis you're going into, because that itself is kind of an art form. And I feel like I think a lot of people, like I know a lot of my students are sort of inherently against poetry because they have this idea of what poetry is or isn't in terms of, the form, and it has to rhyme and A-B-A-B, and also that they think a lot of poetry is just kind of incomprehensible.
I think it's taught poorly, at your level, I'm sure you're teaching it well, but I think it's taught poorly, unfortunately, in many cases. Even as early as grade school, certainly by junior high school, and in some high schools do okay. And so it's my experience teaching it, because I've also taught in higher education, as you do, is that students, really just want to feel like there's some sort of incomprehensible code, or I've got a key to unlock the meaning, that they'll never have access to the set of keys that tell you what a poem means. And there's a lot of emphasis on the meaning, I just read something Billy Collins wrote, and he said, instead of emphasizing so much what does this poem mean, we should maybe talk about where it goes.
Yeah.
And I certainly, when I teach, I do things that I like to bring in. There's a number of people who have set poems that were initially poems, but set them to music, and I often start off with a couple of those where we might, in Israel here, for instance, David Broza has put One Art by Elizabeth Bishop in English to beautiful music. It's recorded with Sean Colvin and Jackson Brown, actually, with him. And I've played that, and then we study the poem, and all of a sudden they realize that when we're talking about even when we are talking about a structure and a rhyme and the rhythm of the poem, that what we're talking about is a song.
Yeah.
So I often use music to get into it. It's not the only way I do it, but I agree that students are often turned off to it. I think it's because it's not taught in a celebratory way or a joyful way.
That's a good point.
You know what I mean? I mean, not all poems are joyful, but there's joy in the language and the communication.
Yeah, and just studying it line by line and how it unfolds.
Right. Yeah, where does it go? What's it doing? What's it saying?
Where's the poet taking you? I use music. I mean, obviously, like, the Bookends Review is named after the Simon and Garfunkel song and album. And, you know, who's a better example of, like, at least an American songwriter who's also a poet? Maybe Dylan or Leonard Cohen. But it's, like, it's very easy there. And,
I've actually used – Paul Simon wrote, Richard Corey was originally a poem written in the earlier part of the 20th century by Robinson, by a poet.
Mm-hmm.
And Simon modernized it, set it to music, you know, but it's captures the same sense of the poem. So that's actually one of the ones I've also used when I take one that's been set, albeit a variation on the words, and then look at the poem. I like Paul Simon. I think he's a poet.
Yeah,
also Bob Dylan, Leonard Cohen. I mean, who's also set. The Lorca poem to Take This Waltz is the song, the Leonard Cohen song. I think the poem is a slightly different title, Vienna Waltz or something, but it's amazing.
It's interesting how that overlaps. When I write about music primarily, I would say, and my focus is progressive rock and progressive metal.
Okay.
And they reference that a lot too. Like, you know, there's the Genesis album Lamb Lies Down on Broadway that references Wordsworth, and there's Brian Wilson's Smile that also references Wordsworth. So I'm always interested in that too, and the references that most people probably don't know where they came from. And obviously, like Kate Bush too, doing that sometimes.
Yeah, well, it's a little bit out of that genre, but Bruce, the King, he did a whole album that was inspired by poetry and poems.
Yeah, it's amazing how widespread it actually is. And I think it helps alleviate the students' fears and just, I would say, like, outsiders, but just people who have this preconceived notion of poetry, and you tell them, well, this is poetry, or this song that you like was inspired by a poet.
Right.
Sort of normalizes it in a way.
Yeah. I also like to have them, like, perform them and read.
Yeah, it's always interesting, too.
Really get it, you know, get into the sounds of it. I really do think that They get stuck on that idea that there's a coded meaning here, that you have to break the code, and I want them to hear them and play with them and play with the words.
Yeah, and hear how the artists themselves interpret it. Again, maybe it's open to, like, your own reading of it, too. If you recite somebody else's, maybe you give it a different meaning just by how you say it.
Exactly.
So moving back to the website.
There are a lot of recordings.
Yeah, totally.
Sorry.
That's right. So moving back to the website, though, you have a Patreon, which is there's a lot of things I always want to do for Bookends, but, you know, between teaching and writing about music, it's sort of like I never really focus too much on all of these aspirations I have for what to do and what I want my editors to help me with and all. And one of which is Patreon. So I wonder what your main motivations and hopes for it are, and then also in what ways do you think it helps and maybe even hinders the creative process and the ability to gain fans.
I have to say that I have not done the Patreon well or right. I think I have two or three people who have signed up. Mm. the more I read about it, I am, you know, it's like you have to do a whole marketing plan.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm a little bit concerned. I think I need to have the fans first and then turn to the Patreon. So to tell you the truth, Patreon hasn't done anything for me because I haven't done it right, according to what I've read. Mm. And in the end, I'm moving more towards, you know, I've only done a little bit of my book page so far, and I've encouraging people to, I'm telling them that basically I'm giving them the links that I have affiliates. So in terms of funding for the blog, if people, I hope they click, Amazon isn't listening, I hope they click on IndieBound more than Amazon,
okay.
But I have affiliate links on both so that if they buy my book or some other book from Amazon or from IndieBound, they get I get a little bit of a very small amount of the proceeds, but you know, a quarter here or a dime there. But it's, you know, I've gotten a little bit of money that way, not a lot. Not, I can't say that it pays for anything yet. Maybe it will.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah. So basically, I don't know if you know what IndieBound is, but it's it's for those who might be hearing or reading the interview and don't know, it's a independent bookstore's online hub. So you can go and you can either find the closest independent bookstore to where you are, or you can order a book online from an independent bookstore that will ship it to you. And you can sort of bypass the Amazon scene.
Yeah, it's a great way to sort of cut out the corporate middleman and just see what else is out there.
Yeah, yeah. And to support our independent bookstores, which are the ones that are most likely to buy poetry books by me or you or
yeah.
Someone who hasn't had a big New York press.
Yeah, all the people you meet at AWP, I guess, for one thing.
Have you been to AWP?
I went this past February.
Okay.
It was interesting. It was kind of overwhelming. Because I was stuck between sitting at the booth and trying to sell journals and spread the word. And I think I did a pretty good job of spreading the word to people who came over. But then I wanted to spend like half the day running around handing out business cards to like all of the other booths and couldn't really focus on that. I left my poetry writer there too much or too long, I think. But it was a really interesting experience. I want to go back. But as you said with Patreon, like I want to go back when we do have a bigger following, when it can sort of, I guess, just be more justified to have a presence there.
Right. It seems to me that you have to – they talk about building a campaign. Not just – I mean, Patreon has a lot of supportive material, but if you get – there are third parties that also give you supportive material. Some of them want to sell you a service. But
yeah.
You really have to build some sort of campaign, and a lot of what I've read suggests you have to build a campaign, quote-unquote a campaign, which sounds like war talk, doesn't it? that you have to build this up and find all these followers and who are really going to be interested in your work and what you're doing before you even open the Patreon.
Yeah.
And I've also read for crowdfunding that it's useful to get a number of friends and family and whoever to pledge ahead of time to you to agree with you that they'll support you,
yeah.
So that when you begin it, you get some traffic immediately. In terms of getting seen on the sites of the crowdfunders, whether it's Patreon or Kickstarter or whatever, you have to actually have a lot of action in the first couple of weeks, first couple of days, first few hours.
No, I'm sure it's a lot of time and effort, but it's worth it if it's a passion project. If you care enough about it, you'll put it in. It's just finding the time to even focus on it.
Or if you're like Amanda Palmer and you already have thousands and thousands of dedicated fans who would cross the earth for you.
Yeah, that helps.
Which she deserves. I don't begrudge her it at all. It's wonderful. But, you know, she's the first person I saw who did a Patreon and you know, she already had such a fan base at the time of people who would have probably written checks for her on the spot.
Huh. Yeah, it must be nice.
Yeah.
So then onto your third book of poetry, War Surrounds Us. It's inspired by the Israel-Hamas conflict of summer 2014, quoting from the press release, of course, an emphasis on resisting violence, exploring how war affects families and daily life. Which to me strikes, not to get into all of that, but sending, bombing Syria as we recently did. Kind of makes me think of that too, just trying, starting conflicts. So I wonder, though, the first question about it is how much is based on personal experience versus imagined experiences and commentaries?
No, it's entirely personal experience because I was here in Israel at the time and I was writing this as it unfolded. But some of it, I mean, the opening poem is literally found poetry. It's sort of breaking news. I modify it, edit it, and break it up, but it's sort of the things that were coming up as we knew that it was about to start, and as I knew, most people could tell that the conflict was at the boiling point, and we're following the breaking news to see what was going to happen, the missiles were coming over from Gaza, Israel was was escalating that, de-escalating the situation. And so the first poem is a lot of collected pieces, but most of it is literally autobiographical. I mean, it's poetry. I don't want people to read it and decide that every single word happened exactly like that. I wrote poetry, but it's my son Moshe's in it. There's literally things we went to. We did the night after we all had to go down into the bomb shelter because they were shooting rockets at Jerusalem and aimed in this general area. We went to a firehouse with this preschool on a field trip. And the whole idea, you know, we ended up, you know, like spraying a fire hose with a bunch of us holding it and the kids holding it. Somehow the relationship of the fire hose and the missiles and all that get mixed up into a poem. Near the end, I mean, very sadly, his preschool teacher always used to tell him about her Moshe at home. And he was in the IDF at the time, and he was one of the casualties of the war. Just after Moshe ended with the preschool and was graduating on. So he never really encountered that. I have to say, sort of, I'm happy about that given his age was...
Oh, I'm sure.
Three or something. But four, three, I guess three. But so a lot of this is an experience, but there's a surreality that happens. I noticed this that summer I was visiting in the second Lebanon war broke out. I was staying in the north, and that was the hot spot. That's where the rockets were falling. Literally fell in the neighborhood where I was staying, but
oh, wow.
I wasn't there at the time. I happened to come down to Jerusalem for a film festival the day the war broke out, which the gods were looking after me, I guess. But I ended up having to relocate to Jerusalem. They were actually evacuating the north and asking non-essential people to not be there. I had friends who worked in the hospital who were staying up there, but a lot of the other people I knew were coming down out of the north. And I stayed in Jerusalem. But like that, in Jerusalem, people were going to cafes, you know. It's like you're going to the movies or to music. I mean, I went to a film festival as the war was breaking out, but I mean, you're going to your lives, you know, go to hear a concert on a rooftop or whatever, some jazz music. I mean, these are things that happened that summer. So a lot of the poems juxtapose some of that. It's there's one of the poems where we were up north, even though the war is in the south, we thought we might be away from it, but the Syrian civil war was already starting. We were near the Syrian border. We could actually hear artillery shells, and sort of that whole feeling of the artillery shells. Then we drove into, we were at a U picket orchard in the kibbutz, and then we drove into a small town that was it's definitely a mixed town. It was I just lost it. I want to say who they are, and I almost said Druids. It's not Druids. Oh, gosh. That's bad. Druze. Druze people. Syrian Arabs, but it's in the Golan Heights, and Israeli Jewish people, all in this town, basically getting along. But for all the world, it reminded me of a small town in Minnesota. Literally, there was a tractor pulled up in front of one of the cafes, which I've seen in Minnesota, in the farm towns. And, you know, an old Ford tractor, I think it was. And, you know, we pulled in next in front of a cafe. And other than the fact that the cafe had its sign in Arabic and Hebrew, and we could have, I mean, the food was Middle Eastern food, but the feeling... It was so much like the Middle West, and the surrealism of that. We had just been hearing artillery shells across the Syrian border from this orchard, and here we are in this town that, when you look at it, it just looks like it could be anywhere in the world, probably a farm town with some glass-fronted cafes and stores that the farm people come to. Yeah,
absolutely.
There's a surrealism, so there's a lot of that in the books, and then also trying to think and imagine what it's like for the children in particular, because I was watching Moshe, what it was like for them. We saw fireworks display when we were up in the north, because there was a music festival and they're having fireworks display every night, and how enthralled my son was with the beauty of that. And I was thinking about the kids in Hamas. The fireworks they were seeing were not there for beauty. They were literally missiles destroying buildings and killing people.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, putting those, they're in the same poem, you know, and trying to balance those things out. But, yeah, it's all from a real experience.
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine what it's like to be a 3 or 4 year old and, like, seeing all of that and not being able to differentiate between the difference, because it all kind of, you know, visually might look similar enough to not, you know, and of course as a child you can't appreciate it anyway.
Right, I mean, you're seeing it, but it also has to be terribly frightening, you know. It's, you know, anyway, it's all of that is, but it's, yeah, these poems are really reflections and came out of the experience. At the same time, I went to a concert and there was a Russian musician, a few Arab musicians, Israeli musicians, not Ashkenazi, not European Jews, but Mizrahi, the Eastern Jews. And they were playing this beautiful Middle Eastern music, tight, harmonic, beautiful, lovely music. You think, like, wow, you know, look at these people, you know, the countries these people come from are at war and warring and warring each other, and yet we have this beautiful music here, you know, and these people playing together. So they're moments of beauty.
Yeah, absolutely. I've always wanted to listen to more Israeli music. There's one band that I like called Orphanland, the kind of, like, progressive metal, and then there's a singer-songwriter named Aviv Geffen, who's in a duo called Blackfield, and he writes a lot of kind of like not so much poetry to music, but a lot of social commentary in the music and a lot of protest music. And it is very beautiful. It's very poignant.
Yeah, right. David Brose is more along the line, kind of maybe a folk rock, but he does a lot of interesting stuff, and he also has some training in Spanish.
Oh, okay.
A guitar, so he brings in some Spanish stuff. He speaks Spanish, Arabic, and Hebrew, and uses those. His songs have all three languages and English. But he's, I think, an amazing musician that I like here, too. And a commentary about peace and about people getting along and, you know, the days when the children of the Arabs and the children of the Jews and the children of all the peoples can sit under the olive trees and play and know each other in good company. These are images from one of his songs, for instance.
Yeah.
I don't have the words right, but the images are there.
No, it sounds, if only it were as simple as it sounds in the music and in the poetry. Because logically, it's like we're the same, more or less the same people, geographically we're close enough. But that's, you know, throughout the world, there's all divide over 1% difference in ideology or language or something like that.
Well, you know, you mentioned the bombing in Syria, too. I mean, is another part of the surreality of it? How surreal everything is that, I mean, the poison gas, if there are roads, but you can't actually cross the border into Syria, but if we were to drive, it'd be like driving from Minneapolis to Chicago, about 7 hour drive, 7+ hour drive. So it's less than 400 miles on the roads, shorter straight line. And the actual base that the U.S. bombed is closer. It's more like 250 miles if you were to take the roads. And it's also close. And yet, I don't feel it. Yeah. I mean, any more than you do. I get it the same way you do through the news services and online news. And I don't watch TV, but I have it on online news, and I see the images and definitely know what happened. But you don't feel it in the same way somehow. It's high.
Well, I'm sure.
I don't know. How far is Philadelphia to New York? That's less than 200. Boston, maybe 250 miles?
Yeah, it's closer than that. It's about two and a half hours.
Yeah, I mean, if someone bombed Boston or I don't know, bombed Virginia.
Yeah, I mean, it's not super far, but it's far enough that you still feel kind of distanced from it.
Yeah.
I wonder how people, Jerusalem over there, reacting to what Sean Spicer said about Hitler not using chemical weapons and concentration camps being, what do you say, Holocaust centers? Like, sounds kind of like a euphemism.
Yeah, you call them Holocaust centers. There's a lot, I mean, Haaretz and one of the English language newspapers, it's also in Hebrew, but I can read it in English. My Hebrew's not that great. I mean, there's commentary in the newspapers, online newspapers in print. And some of, I mean, actually, because it is the Pesach holiday, you know, most of Israel's off and everybody's going around and driving to the beaches and to the parks and to the zoo and everything.
Yeah.
So we were actually at the beach with some family and we talked about it a little bit. Just shaking our heads and it's like how ridiculous it is.
Yeah.
I don't like the Trump administration and I definitely recognize that Trump did a lot of bird whistle calls to anti-Semitists and racists. I think Sean Spicer is just ignorant. He just didn't understand. He didn't stop and think before he spoke.
Yeah, it seems to be a lot of them.
I'm not excusing him.
It's just
the privilege of not having to know and not having to pay attention to what you say. You can say it, you're white, you're a man.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone should listen to you.
It's a big part of what
Which
I teach is all about white
I
privilege.
You and I are white men, too.
Yeah. No, I mean, I teach, people are always, some of my students are surprised because not only, you know, am I a heterosexual white male, but I'm bald. So I've had some, very few people, I think it's dying out, but some people who associate that, you know, being a skinhead. And then they're like, well, you're Jewish. So how does that work? Like, because I'm not that way. But yeah, the white privilege idea. But didn't Trump also say something about I'm the least anti-Semitic person you've ever met? I don't know why everything with him is like a competition.
I think it's always, everyone pretty much laughed at that one here.
Yeah, it's no like
yeah. I mean, that was just considered ridiculous.
It doesn't. It's like a schoolyard, you know, it's a schoolyard argument or something.
Sorry, I met Elias, so you know.
Yeah, exactly. Harrowing book that was.
But you know, there are far less anti-Semitic people than.
Exactly. So going back to the book for a bit, though.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds weird to say, like to ask, do you have any favorite pieces from it? Because that it almost sounds,
I do.
I don't know, insulting, because it's not a pleasant, you know, it's not an enjoyable thing, I guess.
I mean, well, you know, there are some poems I left out, and I'd say the reader should be grateful to me to having had the good sense to leave them out, that I wrote during that time. Favorite ones came fairly quickly as The Cost of Yellow, because just because of the way it unfolded, I drove to campus where I was teaching in Tel Aviv, and there are these, on the blog post that I put up before, and I actually have the pictures of the yellow, the trees were covered with yellow blossoms, but the petals had also carpeted the parking lot with yellow. This is part of the surreality, you know, going in, it's just beautiful. It was warm spring day, and you know, you can smell the sea air because the campus was close to the Mediterranean. Go in for a meeting. In the middle of the meeting, the sirens go off. We have to go to a safe room. Come out. I actually hear some distant explosions, which were probably the Iron Dome takeouts of some missiles.
Okay.
As I'm getting into my car, and the poem I wrote about it, it's one of the ones I felt captures some of that surreality, surrealness, the best. So I've liked it. Interestingly, not one of my favorite poems originally has become one because a number of reviewers, I mentioned Haaretz newspaper, they ran it on their online English site as a poem of the week.
Oh, great.
As a poem again. Yeah, I was very honored to have Haaretz, the national newspaper, run it. But, a couple of other reviewers picked it out and chose to run it with a review. And when I wrote it, I hadn't caught it. But as I reread it from their perspectives and from what people wrote about it and see, yeah, there's actually more to it than some of it must have been flowing from the unconscious because, I mean, as I read it again and again, it works for me. It is one that's more commentary in some ways because it's talking about everyone lining up the troops and getting ready for the war again and again. The title is again. reads well. That one, both that one and The Cost of Yellow read fairly well. By that I mean when I'm done reading it, the audience is they're in the poem. They're in some sort of, you know, there's a state that the audience gets in, and you can feel.
Yeah, it's great.
And you can feel it happening as you're reading, and it actually helps me with the reading. You know, like I get in that state. We get in that state together, and I think I read it better.
Yeah, you bounce off each other's energy.
Yeah, and those two poems are particularly. I've read a number of other poems. Mosquitoes works well that way too. But The Cost of Yellow and Again are two of my favorites.
Oh, great.
To answer that question, yes, I do have. I mean, you know, 5 years from now or 10 years from now, I may hate those poems and like some others better, or hate the whole book. I don't know. But right now, that's where I'm at.
No, I mean, I've spoken to so many people who say it's hard to choose, and I mean, to a certain extent, it is. It's all obviously all hard, very hard to be objective about it, I guess. But
it's entirely hard to be objective. I have to say that my reasoning for liking them has more to do with subjectivity, how they feel and how they work.
Yeah. So now, I guess in a larger scope, do you feel that artists have a responsibility to comment on the world around them? Because, I mean, it's what, especially with poetry, I mean, I guess it's what a lot of poetry inherently does, but you even hear about people saying, like, celebrities shouldn't comment on political events, and who are they? And, you know, I've had discussions with people.
Poets aren't celebrities, usually.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
We can get away from I think there's, I would make a distinction between poets and celebrities. I think the celebrities have the right, and perhaps it's morally reasonable for them to use their public position to speak morally and ethically about things that they see that are going wrong. I think poets are always engaged in the world, even if we aren't writing politically. I mean, I don't believe in a absolute hard truth.
Yeah,
but I do believe that we seek ways of understanding the world from our time and context and to the best of our ability. And so I think we have to comment on it. And I am an activist. I do write political poetry. I have a chapbook. Faria Books has a chapbook series, Locofo Chaps.
Mm-hmm.
The editor is doing it. 100 wanted to do 100 political chapbooks in the first 100 days, and he hit 100 chapbooks before the first 100 days. I have one in that called Breakfast at the End of Capitalism, and it's all political.
that's a quite a loaded title. It's interesting.
Thanks. It's actually the title of one of the pieces. It's on my blog. If you wanted to read, you can actually download. If you search Locofo Chaps on Google, you can download all of the chapbooks as PDFs for free.
Okay.
If you want print copies? There's a fee for the, there's a, you know, they sell them for not very much. I think it's $5 or something.
No, I'm sure.
But free downloads of the PDFs. Hey.
Yeah.
So I do think that poets do have a duty to do it, and I also think it's a long tradition. I've written about this a little bit on my blog and for the B-Zine about that. Jamie from the B-Zine reblogged wanted to put the article into one of the issues that I wrote on the blog. But basically, there's a long tradition we have in the 20th century, better charted perhaps, but you know, Carolyn Forché. This is an anthology of basically activist poetry going back hundreds of years.
Oh, okay.
And has written about it too. You know, as not just the anthology she put together, she's written about this, about the long tradition of it. I came back from one of my days of graduate school, and my mother happened to be over the house visiting, and I was talking something about Yeats. I remember she sort of shocked me. She says, "Oh yeah, I remember when I heard him read. It was really hard to understand, and he talked about politics all the time." First of all, I was shocked that my mother had heard Yeats read, but this was in Philadelphia. Yeats came to Philadelphia, and okay. She was young. But it was in the early first part of the 20th century, first half of the 20th century, sometime. and she happened to be able to go here, speak and read. And she complained a little bit to me about how much he spoke of politics. That's what she remembered, his Irish brogue and how much he talked about politics. But, I mean, Yeats definitely wrote about the Irish situation in the early 20th century revolutions, the massacre, 1919 massacre, and other things. But it goes back. Shakespeare was a political poet. His plays, maybe not in the way we think. He wasn't necessarily a protest poet.
Yeah.
The history plays were often about, it had a political context and a political interpretation and set up the historical figures in certain ways that reflected well on the Elizabethan reign.
Yeah, absolutely. It goes back since people have been writing and people have been voicing their opinions. As you're speaking,
I think so.
As you're speaking about, it makes me think of Lenny Bruce, who was, from what I understand, like the first comedian to sort of get political and social. And a lot of people have a similar reaction of, you shouldn't be talking about that.
Yeah, it got political. I think he got also in trouble for profanity, but it was such a related. The profanity was related to politics, and it was a political statement. I don't know if he's the first. He certainly was, in the middle of the 20th century, he made a big splash with it. I can't comment. I don't know enough about the history of it one way or the other, but I'm not questioning. I don't mean that to be a question. I just don't know whether he's the first.
No, yeah.
He certainly. He predates me in a way, but he was a big figure as I was growing up. We were aware of him. I grew up in the 60s.
Yeah.
Graduated from high school in the early 70s.
I wish I did.
Our hero was George Carlin, of course.
Yeah, well, he just took, 5 years after Lenny Bruce, and he was saying all the same stuff and getting, applauded instead of getting arrested for it.
Yeah, things had changed. But, I did a documentary film project. I did the research and writing for it. We never got the funding for the filming, but on Yiddish theater. And it's interesting. I mean, they were, Yiddish theater did a lot of commentary, including political commentary that some of the theaters got in trouble with. They're also the first lesbian kiss on the Broadway or off Broadway was in the Yiddish theater play in the early 20th century, and everybody involved got arrested.
Oh, wow.
The producer, the director, the theater owner, the actor, actresses, actually, because it was a lesbian kiss. But now that's something people don't get arrested for either. But
that's true.
Still controversial.
But, yeah, unfortunately, it is still controversial.
100 years later.
Yeah, the question is, will it ever not be somewhat controversial? But,
possibly for some people. There are some people who view theater as evil and devil's tool. I'm sure that people in IS and some of the extreme right evangelicals don't think much of theater, but...
Unfortunately, yeah. Yeah, people always be outraged at what other people do with their lives.
Yeah.
For some reason.
True enough.
Yeah. So the last question about that book is the cover of it is very striking to me. It's not flashy. I mean, it's black and white, obviously, but I find it really chilling. There's a lot to look over. It's several figures looking over, from what I can tell, several figures looking over Earth after crashed into the ground between them. So I wonder how
it
was the moon.
I also thought it looked like Earth, by the way, but the artist told me it was the moon.
Oh,
they're kind of howling at the moon. Playing with the moon.
Oh, okay. Well, so how does it provide a visual connection to the poems? Was this always like the one option, or were there other ones and you decided on this one?
I chose this one. The artist is talk about social networks. An artist is a Facebook friend of mine, and actually we live near each other in Minnesota and have lots of real world friends in common and somehow never met until after I was here. But we've been longtime friends on Facebook and socially here on social networks. And we've now met in person and hung out together in Minnesota too. But I like his work, which is very surrealistic. And I asked him if he'd like to do a cover. And he didn't have the time at that particular time in my time frame to do something original, But he presented me many options, and I chose this one. And I tell you, there's a couple of things. It did actually strike me as like the Earth had crashed, or there was something. It's a dreamscape, and it's part dream, it's part nightmare.
Okay, yeah.
To me, it does have that feeling, like you talked about. There is something a little sinister about it, and it has a lot. It has kids through it, and because the poems had kids through it, the poems have music through it. That's actually a trope that recurs, not just in the one that I talked about of the different musicians. Music tends to be a trope in my writing anyway.
Me
also
too.
Play guitar and do improvisational jazz and stuff. I'm a musician, but it struck me. I liked it. I have to say that a lot of it is subjective. I looked at it and I thought, wow, that somehow it fits to me. I do talk about sunrise and moon in it as well. So when it turned out that it was a moon, when he explained that to me before I did the book, I was still okay with it. It's called The Evolution of Music.
Oh.
And it seems to me that there's a relationship between music and poetry, of course. And I think the idea is that, you know, responding to the moon in some way is part of where music came from. It's probably, if that's so, it may be where chants and poetry came from, too. Charting the path of the moon.
No.
Who knows?
Yeah, I mean,
but
certainly
I have the same feeling. I have to say they have the same feeling, and it's sort of like we're playing. There's something sinister in that, and the darkness around the original artwork had black around it, and I just continued the black around the whole cover.
Yeah,
I did work on I like to design the covers, so.
No, it's certainly, I mean, it's definitely striking, and it seems to fit in well, at least, emotionally with the contents within it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I thank Jerry Ingeman, the artist. It's,
no, it's really interesting.
Last time I was in the U.S. last fall, he was having a show that was scheduled to end the week before I was going to arrive in Minnesota, and I said, oh, darn, I'm going to miss it. It would have been fun to show up. I could have pulled out my book because this piece of art was in the show.
Yeah.
Pulled out my book and read a poem or two from it and talked to the gallery and got them to extend this show. We actually did a reading in St. Cloud, Minnesota. And I read from the book, and I read from the poem reading to the other book, the poem reading after the Toad's Garden. And we gave me a print of the artwork on the cover. I was quite honored that he did that. It's very sweet of him.
Yeah, it is.
But it was a very fun reading.
I bet. And speaking of the Pomerania after the Toad's Garden, it seems more playful. It seems to have, as opposed to having, I guess, like sort of a darkness to it and a social commentary and a real life inspiration, it seems more fanciful and more abstract and more, I don't know, just more like imaginative in that sense.
It is. To tell you the truth, a lot of it was written before the war broke out.
Oh.
And had the war not broken out, this book might have come out first. But the war sort of interrupted it. I was writing the other things first. So much of it was written as a result after that time period. But the Toad's Garden section was written before, this actually about the summer before, almost a year before, 2013. But there are a series of experiments, a lot of them. I actually invited people on social media to contribute five freely associated words, and I take a group of those, five or six of those, and use those words to inspire and help me begin the writing, following some Dadaist kind of automatic writing techniques,
mm-hmm.
found poetry kind of things, I guess.
Yeah, the description of this, because it gets its name from the story of the stories with the woman with the beard and the toad, and then a different set of stories with the palm reader. And it kind of makes me think of Lewis Carroll and just the sort of like fairy tale aspect.
Well, there is some math in it, so there you go. Some math and science. It isn't dark, but I do have some social commentary, I think, in it. And then there's a thread of the woman with the beard sort of, as I started writing these, kept wanting to remember things. And I say she kept wanting to do it because it didn't initially come from me. All of a sudden, I realized that the one with the beard, after I'd written something, it reminded her of something from the past. Hmm. And I started writing a series. It follows her. There's fragments, scenes from her life before she got to the present frame of the stories that we're reading. It covers some stuff from the 60s and the 70s. She's on a commune for a while. She's in Haight-Ashbury. She's at a Grateful Dead concert.
Yeah, all the staples of the scene.
All the staples of the scene. And different stuff. The palm reading is different. The palm reading is a little bit more narrative and a little bit less experimental, I think. The first couple of pieces that bring the palm reader herself in and suggest, to me, the other stories were like sort of the various branchings that could have happened.
Oh, okay.
From the people who encounter the palm reading. I don't think that's obvious in the book. I think that was just helped me to write it and organize it.
I mean, leaves more for the reader to interpret and put their own spin on it.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. And you describe it as a hybrid. Blurs the lines across poetry, fiction, nonfiction, cultural criticism. What's interesting to me is heard, because I haven't really published creatively enough, but it's a significant amount, I guess, but I haven't really done much in years because I do so much music writing and teaching that I never really sit down to do it. So I'm starting to compile my first collection of fiction and poetry, because that's the only way I can really have enough to even warrant a collection of anything is to put it all together. But I've heard a lot of people say...
My master's thesis was both fiction and poetry, and both.
Okay, so it's not that... I mean, I'm sure it's not that unusual, but I've heard a lot of people who say, you'll never sell it, or nobody will publish it unless it's all fiction or all poetry. Don't put the two together. It's a hybrid. But clearly, it sounds like that's what you've done.
Well, no, it's a little different. To be honest, my master's thesis, a lot of it is in the first ebook that came out, The World Behind It, Chaos. But it's the fiction had never got. I mean, there wasn't enough fiction for a collection. There were couple of short stories that have been published separately, but I haven't had a book. And I don't know how many. I think it may be true. It's hard to market. So where do the bookstores put it on their shelves because of the way things are organized, not because of the way people write. A lot of people write both, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just like a lot of people are artists in more than one medium. Some people write and paint, or like to take a very famous example, who is a printer and did all sorts of woodcuts and beautiful artwork as well as beautiful poetry. But some are musicians and writers, and you're interested in music, obviously.
Yeah.
But what I mean by hybrid, in a way, is there's something called hybrid writing. Marcela Sulak, she's in Israel, but she's published a book, again, an anthology of hybrid writing and discussion of what hybrid writing is. She's not the only person who does it or talks about it, but she's a friend of mine, so I know what she has had to say about it. But it's an intersection. It's where a lot of these pieces read like poems. In fact, the Isaros Press editor working with me, when it suggested the layout is these are very short pieces, flash fiction, but we've actually made them even shorter in some of the pages. There's like maybe two paragraphs and then a lot of white space. There's some silhouette art that an artist here in Israel, Ayelet Cohen, did to emphasize that there's a bit of prose poetry feeling to it. Some of it, the language, the play of sound, the play of rhythm is like poetry. And yet some of the themes come in. My dissertation was on masculinity and gender, so there's a lot of gender stuff that has the woman with the beard as a main character in the toad's garden.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of gender stuff. There's other cultural criticism. There's a lot about marketing, the economy, commodification, capitalism, woven into it. There's some science woven into it, as I mentioned, some theoretical science. There's certainly some theology and mysticism from a Kabbalistic woven into it, as well as some narrative and some story and some fiction. Yeah. In that way, the hybrid is sort of, I call it fiction. It is fiction. But if you read it, you're going to find things that read a lot like poetry.
Mm.
And yet you're going to also find some things that are, you know, talking about an asteroid approaching the Earth that really happened, or talking about some strange sounds that have been heard in different places, which when I did these on the blog, I could put links to some of the stories about some of the real things that are woven in here, which is one thing in the print version. I love the print version, but I lost that.
Yeah, unfortunately. I mean, it's just, I think, a great statement about how boundless, you know, creative writing can be, that you don't have to label it, or you don't have to, like, fit into any sort of box. Like, it is, like, when people send us submissions, I sort of have to classify in what, like, prose versus fiction. There are differences, as you say, but I sort of just go by however the writer defines it, that's how I'll, you know, tag it.
Right.
And if it's good, it's good. If it's not, it's not. It's however they classify it is what it is.
And I think, you know, sometimes categorizations and genres, I mean, genres can be useful, I suppose, but I'm willing to cross them off.
Yeah.
I do that with music, too. You know, I like folk music. I can like some heavy metal music, too. I don't. My only electric guitar is actually an old Gibson Jazz from the 40s, so it's a hollow body. It doesn't really do well for a for heavy metal sound. But, you know, I can, all this stuff, from classical music to heavy metal music to punk to experimental weird sounds that people produce electronically today.
Yeah.
It's all music, too. And I think the same thing with writing. You know, the words are here. It's there are conventions that say this is the genre, but there's also something to be said about crossing those genres.
Yeah.
And mixing in, you know, a bit of an essay here and there. And, you know, they do it. You know, John Fowles, the British author,
mm-hmm.
in The French Lieutenant's Woman, has a long discursive essay section, basically. I mean, it's not as part of the novel, but he's discussing the number of brothels there were in Victorian England to the population, and how much, while sex was being basically suppressed and on the surface level, there was a whole lot of it emerging, given the number of brothels and things there were. And I mean, he cites sources and everything, you know, in his research. And he does this at a couple different points. He pauses. It's very postmodern. You know, I guess hybrid is postmodern or post-postmodern, whatever that might be.
Yeah, exactly. How do you even classify that? What is that? What are those distinctions? Speaking of music, I mean, with a lot of music, is Jethro Tull folk rock? Is it progressive rock? There's a band Renaissance that sometimes gets classified as progressive, but there's a lot of classical.
Is my camera on?
No.
My camera's not on, is it?
So
you don't happen to see that I'm wearing Ian Anderson, Thick as a Brick 2 t-shirt, and you mentioned Jethro Tull.
No, I didn't. One of the highlights of my career as a, you know, one of the highlights of doing this in general is I get to, you know, when I lived at home especially, but I could tell my dad, guess who I'm talking to? Because he raised me on this stuff. One of the highlights, one of the only times I've ever been nervous to do an interview was when I interviewed Ian Anderson.
Was it?
Yeah, because I'm 29 now.
He might be laid back. I don't know how he was.
He's pretty nice, but he's very, you know, you could tell he's kind of proud of himself, I guess. Which he should be. He's a genius.
He's intense, yeah.
But
yeah, I think he
would, I spend, when I, you know, I went into high school when I was 13 listening to, like, what I consider real Genesis, because I considered, you know, the Genesis died when Steve Hackett left, according to me and a lot of other people. But I listened to A Passion Play daily for months. So to talk to the guy who wrote that, which I think may be the greatest piece of music I've ever heard, maybe, was intimidating.
Yeah, I could see that. I used to do a radio show way, way back in the 80s and early 90s in Minneapolis, where I got to interview a lot of singer-songwriters, including a number of heroes and stuff. It was amazing.
Yeah.
Pete Seeger was probably the biggest name that I met in that round. Richie Havens.
Okay. Yeah, so I tell like a lot of my friends and, you know, even my students sometimes I'll talk, because I taught a course on how to write about music.
Oh, nice.
And I had a student who didn't know who Bob Dylan was, and we listened to the Beatles, and they didn't appreciate it. I was like, you guys are music majors. How do you – I played like all sorts of progressive. I played like Jethro Tull. I played Genesis. I played Gentle Giant, King Crimson, and
amazing,
all that sort of – all that stuff. I'm still proud that
I used to listen to King Crimson, but I want to say it was the late 60s or early 70s. When did King Crimson come out? I'm sure I listened to him 69. In high school, 72. Huh? 69, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
That was when I was in high school. I started high school in 69, fall of 69.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I'm still proud.
Yeah, King Crimson, yeah, the band.
I reviewed one of Robert Fripp's albums with Theo Travis, and I didn't like it, and somehow he found out and wrote a blog post calling me an idiot. Which was apt, because I didn't know what I was talking about back then, but I was just super excited that Robert Fripp wrote about me. It was weird.
There you go. That's right. I don't care what you say about me, just as long as you spell my name right.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what I write reviews now, and people complain about them. It's like, well, I'm glad you read this, whatever you thought of it. Same thing with, like, fiction and, you know, creative writing. But yeah, like bands like My Vision Orchestra or Fairport Convention, how do you classify them?
Yeah.
But they're onto them, you know, their own category, I guess. They are just singular entities.
I think the best are the best artists, the best musicians. I mean, how do you classify, you mentioned Blake, how do you classify Blake? You know, people do, or they try to, but he's pretty much Blake.
Yeah.
Or Emily Dickinson. She's Emily Dickinson.
Yeah, so many of them. I mean, that's otherwise you're sort of like copying others, I guess. You're not really being an individual.
Right.
So speaking of that, though, you also do photography. And not that you have to sort of... Huh?
Yeah.
Not that you of have to choose one over the other, but do you consider yourself more of a poet, of a fiction writer, of a photographer, of an essayist?
I am probably more of a poet. I've certainly written more poetry than anything. Photographer is I do photography. It's a different level. I haven't. Some of my work has been published in art magazines or online, and I put it a lot of it I use as the base of digital art that I put on my blog.
Yeah.
But I really think of myself, I guess, as a poet. I don't think about it too much. I mean, I've done all sorts of odd things. I've done sculpture. I've done cast bronze and cast iron sculptures that I really like. I've done painting. I play guitar. But a lot of that feeds poetry. It used to be, when I was younger, I'd go back and forth between guitar and writing more than anything else. Digital photography made it cheaper so I could start affording to really become a photographer more. To be honest, when you had to, you know, deal with film and darkness,
yeah, absolutely.
Or it was more pricey. But I still play a lot of guitar. I don't focus on that as much. I used to sit and play my scales and practice and play intensely, and I played with a group for a while, but you know, we never made any money, but got a couple of free meals for our playing.
That's nice.
I used to say made enough money to pay for the strings.
Yeah, it's unfortunate of being a musician. I mean, of being any creative type, I guess, is just you don't get really paid much. It's just the opportunity to perform is the reward, I guess. It may be like you get to stay there for a night, or you get the meal, you get the transportation.
Yeah, I mean, I've gotten exactly paid for some readings. Poetry basically paid for me to make it reimbursed the costs of making the trip, and so a couple of the places I read put me up, and they just say they put you up, and there's a meal, and the nice people that you meet, and there's an audience that's interested in the poetry, and that's what you do. Would be nice to make a living at it.
Yeah, absolutely.
A lot of us teach. I mean, you teach.
Yeah.
I haven't been teaching for about a year now, but done a whole lot of teaching before that, but 30 years almost of teaching higher education. But I write because I have to. It's one of the things sometimes when people ask me, I don't think I could. There are times when I got frustrated and tried to stop, and I found that I couldn't, and I was very unhappy. And I basically have to. And the guitar's that way, too. I can go for a while without taking pictures, and right now I had a single lens reflex that I managed to lose. And so I'm using my iPhone mostly for photography. It works, but I'd like to get back to a real camera. But I don't have that same unhappiness that I would have if I didn't have a guitar nearby or if I wasn't writing.
Well, it's great that that's what it's supposed to all be about, is the drive to do it. Whether, you know, anything sort of after that is more superficial, and it's not about the art itself. If you do it for the money or anything like that.
Yeah. I guess I believe that. I'd still like to get paid.
No, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there's so
Come
many...
Come on, people, give me some money! No.
No, it's true. I mean, even like writing bookends costs some money, and doing, you know, and even though it's not, I wouldn't say it's an art form. I mean, I guess it could be, depending, but like a lot of YouTubers, for example, with YouTube's cutting back funding, and a lot of YouTubers are sort of saying, even, you know, even if it's really just silly, like throwaway videos, are sort of saying, like, we won't be able to do this if we're not getting paid. And it is that question of putting the time and effort, even to shooting a YouTube video, is it worth it if you're not getting paid for it? And I guess to a more artistic like scale, being a poet or a musician, is the same argument you have to make with yourself.
Yeah, no, I think so. We have to make money somehow, but oftentimes it's some other way, you know?
Yeah.
Being a banker or an insurance salesman or
a teacher,
a doctor, to mention a few famous modernists.
Yeah, exactly. Who's like by day they do something relatively conventional, and then a lot of people didn't, you know, in some cases people didn't know until after they passed away that they had all of these pieces written or all these pieces of music recorded, and did this whole other sort of side to them.
Sure.
So final question is just in general, what's next for you? Like, what are you working on? What are you hoping for 2017?
To tell you the truth, moving it out, it's still, I think it still has a byline with my name in it. I may take that out too.
Oh.
And do more focusing on, I mean, still have, you know, list myself as my blog in some way, and probably still put a lot of my work in there. But I think I'm going to do more of that. It's really taken off this year. I mean, I'm not a huge blog by any means, but I'm you know, last month I had 10,000 some visitors, which is huge for me.
Oh, wow.
And April so far is on scale to go above that. I've been averaging 500 a day.
Oh, wow.
Views, not visitors, views, 500 views. What I'm happy to say is that, you know, when you look at, there's all these statistics that you probably know about these that you can look at for your blog to see what's happening. And
yeah.
My bounce rate is relatively low. It's under half. It's 40. It ranges from 42% to 49% every week, and and people are seeing or actually viewing a couple of posts. The people who stick around are viewing 2 to 3 posts. The average, if you count, because you count the bounce in, is just under 2 posts per visitor, which is, I mean. That means they're finding enough to look at something else, to look at a second one. I'm sure that there's some who only look at one and some who look at 6, but you know, but it all averages out. So the statistics are looking good, but they've been building, and I've been doing the totally free WordPress. I'm going to see if this build continues and the numbers continue being relatively high. The person is out there doing clickbait mass marketing is laughing at the idea that I think this is high when they get 10,000 or 20,000 a day, but for me that's high.
Yeah, and the content's more worthwhile.
Yeah, I mean, well, yeah, it's, I mean, for a poetry site, I'm very pleased. I think I'm doing well. But I may, with WordPress, if you pay up an annual fee and you can monetize, quote unquote, is you can get some ad, instead of them getting the ad revenue, you share the ad revenue with them, and you can do some more things with customizing it and get some better looking templates to use and stuff. So I'm thinking that may be the direction I go in. I'm always writing. I want to take my books on the road. I haven't really done much of a launch with the palm reading after the Toad's Garden because of the timing of it and everything. I had a problem with my knee and knee surgery, which I'm still recuperating from, so I've kind of been laying low. But I like to get out, maybe in the fall, come to the States and do some sort of a tour where I do some readings for both books.
That'd be great. If you come to Philadelphia, you have to let me know.
Say again?
So if you come to Philadelphia, you'll have to let me know.
I will let you know. I definitely will. I'd love to go to Philadelphia. Actually, both my parents and my grandparents are buried there, so.
Oh, okay.
I haven't been there for a while, so I might go there, if nothing else, to visit the cemetery. But nice to do some poetry, too.
That'd be great.
I still have a cousin in there.
Oh, okay.
In Philadelphia, and it's some second cousins. People were cousins to my father, that side of the family.
Hmm.
My mother's side of the family is more outside of Philadelphia now. They're out more upstate.
Well, hopefully we'll be able to make it. So,
all right.
Yeah, well, thanks for taking the time to speak with me, and good luck with all of it. And I'll let you know when this is going to go up. Yeah, no problem.
All right. Thanks a lot. I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, me too. Take it easy.
Yeah, you too. Take care. Yeah. See you on the social media.
Yeah, exactly. Bye.